This evening I'll be reading a short excerpt from a novel that I just finished on September 16th at 7 p.m. The title is simply the letter V for Vernon, Violet, Victorian, anything you want to go with me. And basically this novel, which I began here at Palmarino 3 years ago, is a tribute to Vernon Lee, to her life, but also to her marvelous supernatural stories, fantastical tales. If you haven't read them, I recommend them highly. I was so taken with them that when I was trying to decide how to write this material, I realized that's what I wanted to do, was tell a supernatural story in the tradition of Vernon Lee. And I set it, just to give you a very brief synopsis, it's set here at Villa Palmarino, but between centuries, the current contemporary time and the 19th century, when Vernon Lee lived here. And it's a sort of a love story, and an American woman writer comes here to write an historical fiction about Vernon Lee, to stay here at Villa Palmarino, and she becomes obsessed. Obsession is always good in literature. And she becomes obsessed, and the spirit or genius loci of Villa Palmarino is Vernon Lee. Her spirit is here, observing this woman, thinking about this woman, watching this woman. And this love develops between them. And I won't tell you any more, except that the novel is split into three perspectives. It alternates between three points of view, and you will hear two of those tonight. The first one is the voice of Vernon Lee, the interior voice of Vernon Lee, and I'll begin with that after an epigraph. And then there is Sylvia Casey, that's the woman's name, there's her point of view, as she's living here for a month. And then there is what she writes, the historical fiction she begins to write about Vernon Lee, and she begins with Vernon Lee's, or Violet Paget's, childhood. And you'll hear that section tonight, the section of Violet Paget's childhood that my protagonist Sylvia is here writing. And then it will end with another excerpt, very brief, from Vernon Lee's point of view, the spirit of Palmarino. It begins with an epigraph from... can everyone hear me? All right. Okay. It begins with an epigraph from Anne Carson's translation of If Not Winter, Fragments of Sappho. Eros, the melter of limbs, now again stirs me. Sweet, bitter, unmanageable creature who steals in. Not one girl, I think, who looks on the light of the sun will ever have wisdom like this. This is the voice of the spirit of Vernon Lee here at Palmarino. She arrived last night, bringing the damage of too much rain. Fell asleep in a bed quilted with old letters, sepia photographs, Italian vocabularies. A train ticket from Rome. This morning the rooster digs leathery talons into his gray pulpit of kindling and crows, raspy, half-hearted. Palma, the German shepherd, skulks past the kitchen garden, vulpine, only a little cunning left in her. In the distance, deep within the stone tower of San Martino, an iron bell tolls. Folding back the ivy-green shutters of an upstairs window, she appears within its frame, auburn hair, lilac pale shoulders. One of Sargent's early portraits. Or a rose, dry between the pages of a book. The story's ending, incomplete, until now.
Thank you.
the childhood of Violet Paget. Château Saint-Léonard, Boulogne-sur-Mer, France, 1856. What to make of this squalling, homely infant, conceived by an English widow of means and a French tutor of vague aristocratic lineage? Of Violet Paget, half-sister to Eugene Lee Hamilton, 11 years her superior and already remote as a distant planet. What to make of this plain little prodigy, born a ruler's width from the schoolroom, her cradle, a four-square stack of 18th-century books, her mother's milk, skirting Voltaire from one breast, dribbling Rousseau from the other. Fated to trail in her mother's restless, volatile wake, Violet's childhood will consist of traveling by horse-drawn carriage from one off-season watering hole to another, from Germany to France to Switzerland to Italy and all the lopsided way around again. Matilda Paget, who fled Britain because she loathed the English Sunday, will shape her daughter's existence into one long, interminable English Sunday, with regimented walks and monologues patched from her own follied, capricious mind. Matilda, who holds all men but her son in contempt, will school Violet herself, will mold this strange, unattractive creature into a formidable brain, a girl who one day will insist on dressing à la garçon, like a man. Wiesbaden, Germany, December 1861. The schoolmaster's eldest daughter, plump yellow braids fastened with scarlet ribbons, smells of cinnamon and sugar, of crushed clove and anise, of the saffronous cookies she has just baked that day with her mother and five sisters. It is nightfall, and Franziska squeezes her little charge's black mittened hand in her own as they leave the marketplace with its temporary forest of Christmas trees, resinous black-green firs, stiff and triangular as polished toys. When a sweep of snow sparkles down in freezing darkness, blowing at a fierce cutting slant across the child's anxious face, Franziska laughs. Ah, mein Klein, do not worry. It's only the miller and the baker quarreling again in heaven. Inside the Paget's rented lodgings, Franziska hurries upstairs to lay a fire in the nursery, while in the candlelit foyer, five-year-old Violet presses one small, keen eye against the iron keyhole of her father's study, beholding a scene in the shape of that keyhole, a round and tapering confusion of greenness, a longish white bit of her father's profile, his thin, pendulous nose, raven's wing of oiled hair, rapier tip of black mustache, spying as he stoops to twist a bit of glassy ornament onto her tree, hers, cut down that morning by her father and shouldered out from the forest. Tomorrow night, Christmas Eve, her tree will blaze with its wax tapers, casting a starry haze over the cheerful tangerines and burnished lady apples, the glass ornaments, and paper cones of sugared walnuts. Sitting close to the nursery fire, sucking on her right thumb, always the right, Violet nests mouse-like in Franziska's lap as her governess reads aloud from their favorite book, Schiller's Child Murderess. Content, she breathes in Franziska's pastry scent, pets the fat plaits of hair, faintly greasy ropes of gold on which to climb into a land of spired castles, serpents, and wicked dragons. Franziska is the most comforting creature on earth. Yet in April she will leave Violet to marry the local upholsterer, who ever since he spotted her in church one Sunday, has besieged the schoolmaster's oldest, prettiest daughter with a blizzard of adoring letters, each more flowery than his most expensive satin fabric, each beginning the same, "My dearest little goldfish." Bernice Dunn, Switzerland, December 1866. Violet's new Swiss governess, Fräulein Marie Schulbach, stands in the white schoolroom high above the Aar River, warming herself beside the blue porcelain stove. She's baking two red apples and heating café au lait to pour into two blue and white bowls, while her pupil, squeaks out dusty sums with a stub of chalk on a black slate. Only when Violet finishes her sums, her German conjugations, and her weekly letter in German to her brother Eugene away at Oxford, "Dearest Bruder, love Violette," accompanied by a little drawing of herself in a short ballet skirt with an envelope in one hand, a quill in the other. Will Marie reward Violet by reading aloud from Goethe or even from one of Grimm's fairy tales? In a succession of deeply silent dark winter days, science, poetry, theory, and legend mix most wonderfully in both of their heads. Perched on Marie Schilbach's knees, her legs and their itchy nut-brown woolen tights dangling nearly to the floor, or settled in Marie's rustling black taffeta lap, Violet dreamily turns the pages of one of their thickly embossed, orange-labeled books as Marie reads from Mozart's letters or Goethe's memoirs, his laureled profile on the cover, or from Violet's newest favorite, Joseph von Scheffel's Der Trompeter von Sackingen, a fantastical tale of roving musicians, a baron's clever daughter, and Hitty Gitty, the magical tomcat. Left mostly alone, Violet and Fräulein Marie Schulbach float like cumulus clouds shot through with the gold of literature, memoir, poetry, and fantasy. While outside their schoolroom, far below, the marbled green and white tumult of the Aar, glacial and aloof, rushes past. Nice, France, December 1867. Near the end of one of their seaside walks along the Promenade des Anglais, with Matilda intoning from a fresh translation of Tom Paine, the inward panorama of human liberty blinding her to physical sea and shore, to the stately, rough lattice pillars of the Egyptian palms, they collide literally with their new neighbors, the Fitzwilliam Sargents, an American couple with two children, John Singer, Violet's age, and his younger sister, Emily. And while Matilda sees nothing useful to walking beyond inflicting into tendentious philosophies and lectures on the corruption of organized religion on her 11-year-old daughter, by contrast, Mrs. Sargent proves to be a free spirit, seeking out ever more fantastical sights, sublime sounds, dramatic, diverting histories. With Matilda's permission, she invites Violet, along with her own two children, to operas, the theater, museums, parks, and galleries, gives revolutionary change of scenery to Violet's shut-up world of books and Spartan walks. And delighted to describe herself as a high priestess of localities, Mrs. Sargent, an amateur watercolorist, introduces Violet to the classic Roman notion of genius loci, or spirit of place. And while her mother hardly comprehends such an adventuresome approach to existence, neither does she object to Violet's being placed from time to time in Mrs. Sargent's care. In Nice, the French doors of the Paget's ground floor apartment open onto a drab garden edged by dwarf roses that at Christmas time set forth a scentless carmine bloom. In this cramped space, Violet and John pass winter afternoons playing at morbid sets of charades. Today, for instance, Violet is not Violet, but Queen Elizabeth, and John is Robert, Earl of Essex, about to be decapitated for treason. Later, they may wander into the haunted, decrepit gardens of Villa Piolle, search for wet, blackened figs that have fallen over the orchard walls into the long yellow grass. Folding a maternal wing over this timid but precocious child, Mrs. Sargent draws Violet close, inviting her to the family's weekly opera night, to their rented home for supper afterwards, where John and Violet, stretched full length on the carpet, draw and paint before rolling onto their backs and piping bits of libretti from Verdi or Donizetti, their breathy, sweet tendrils of song rising to be quieted, then lost in the lavishly corniced pistachio pale ceiling.
Oh,
Villa Borghese, Rome, December 1868. In Rome, Mrs. Paget's pedagogical walks resume. Every sunless afternoon on the cold, empty Pincian Way bordering the Villa Borghese, Violet must endure her mother's ambulatory education, a skewed rhetoric of world history, the postulates of Euclid, a bit of Racine, and always phrenology, the location of causality being halfway between the brows and the ears, alongside ideality and veneration. Teachings ending in unvaryingly with a meager tea at their current lodgings on Piazza Mignonelli. Fortunately, the sergeants have taken up residence nearby in a home at the top of the Spanish steps near Trinità dei Monti. Every morning, 12-year-old Violet waits for John to appear in his Eton pepper and salt jacket, dodging beggars and artist's models, skipping down 7 flights of the Spanish steps, their sallow and gray-veined marble patterns flowing forever down like frozen water. Compared to the Swiss cleanliness of Thun, or the blue-gold indulgent light of Nice with its fashionable lyre-backed chairs, Rome is a grim funerary procession. Filthy streets of slick wine-colored mud and wild stinging nettle, whole seasons of trash carelessly heaped over broken monuments and melancholic statuary, heavy plum and slate skies. Violet feels her every step, however light, sinking into yet another stranger's grave. That first winter in Rome horrifies her, the city a gray place littered and heavy with marble antiquities, starved horses in broken harness, nightmarish crevices of poverty gaping open at every turn. Rome is an endless cemetery, and except for her hours with John, she hates it. Mornings, they slip into the Villa Borghese to wander the park's endless gardens and secret grottos. When the old French cursing warden catches them, setting fire with a magnifying glass to the leathery dark leaves of a bay tree, enfant Melilev, they find fresh entertainment draping themselves over one wall of the Pincian Terrace, pitching handfuls of acorns at a black, mud-spattered sea of grunting pigs huddled outside the Porta del Popolo. And always, there is the pleasure of sitting inside Nazari's cake shop on the Piazza di Spagna, reading novels, sipping from cups of hot chocolate so stiff and thick they must stand their tall spoons upright to see whose will topple first. One winter morning in the Villa Borghese, near the Temple of Diana, splashing through a bronze-dry surf of leaves, they accidentally uncover, lying still against pungent dark soil mixed with pinkish stones, a dead sparrow, flattened, perhaps beneath a horse's hoof, and composed upon an oval bed of its own stomach contents, a small stain of crushed red pomegranate seed. The sight is shocking, sacred. John touches a finger to its drab feathers, still warm, and they wondered how recently the bird must have been winging its way through bay hedges and trees. Moved by the sparrow's death, the children stand before La Fontana di Cavalli Marini, the fountain of seahorses, and each with a cold, chapped hand pressed against the other's heart, they solemnly commit their lives from that moment on to art. Violet as a writer, John an artist. Then they take up running along the wide tops of stone walls, sliding down like quick pale lizards, escaping the warden, who's never far away, enfant Melilev, slipping down silver pathways, avenues of fierce black ilex, vanishing like sprites into the maple, oak, and cypress woods until gasping for breath and holding their sides, they find themselves back on the broad gray Pincian, deserted, freezing, evenly marked by empty benches, flapped as signature lines with no notes. Hotel Molars, Via Gregoriana, Rome, 1869. A clatter of iron-rimmed coach wheels on great square stones, tablets black and undulant as licorice, and barefoot Violet in her muslin nightgown is awake, unlatching the wooden